Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards. Coasters and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Oh yeah, it's Monday, and that means it's time for What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're going to talk about cider this week, because last week was Cider Week, and just to keep that ball rolling, I invited a couple of cider makers and orchardists to come on the show with me today. The first is Ian Merwin. He is the Professor Emeritus of Horticulture and a grower and cider maker at Black Diamond Farm. He spent 14 years in the California horticultural industry and then completed his PhD in pomology, who knew, and plant ecology, and subsequently worked at Cornell University as a research and teaching professor until just recently, 2013. And since 1992, he and his wife have run a 64-acre family farm in Trumansburg. And they grow wine grapes, peaches, plums, sweet and tart cherries, and more than 125 apple varieties. Again, who knew? Black Diamond Cider makes 6 hard cider blends. My other guest is Dan Wilson. He is the proprietor of Slyboro Cider House and Hicks Farm, and he's a longtime grower and cider maker. Both Dan and Ian serve on the New York State Cider Association. So welcome to the show, you guys. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So who was that? Identify yourself so we know whose voice is whose. Okay. And Ian, let me hear you.
Here I am.
Okay. Very good. Just so I know who's talking.
Uh-huh.
Guys, give me an idea of what's happening in the cider industry. Like, how did Cider Week get going? I mean, I know it's been going on for a few years, but it seems to be really growing in scale. I noticed that one of my local restaurants, for instance, was featuring Cider Week, and obviously a bunch of different ciders. How did all that get started?
Yeah, nobody.
Jump in, Ian.
Resurgence, but it's just been exploding. It's been the fastest increasing sector in the alcoholic beverage industry since about 2000.
Wow. And Dan, what were you going to say?
No, I agree. Cider Week happened, I believe the first one was about 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was an effort by the Glenwood Institute up in the Hudson Valley to help promote the burgeoning New York cider industry. And since then, I think they probably had a little bit of influence on the growth of cider and bringing it more to a broader range of consumers. But that kind of happened in conjunction with just a national explosion in the interest in cider. So it's great to be a part of that.
I can imagine. So, I mean, since it's only really been in the last few years that cider has, you know, as you say, exploded, you guys have obviously been making cider for longer than 4 or 5 years. What got you into it even when there wasn't a market? Like, what made you want to become cider makers?
Well, if you grow
I'll start.
One at a time,
we
boys.
We started here at Hicks Orchard and Slyboro Cider House in about the year 2000, experimenting with hard ciders. Our farm has been very much focused on adding value to our crops and to also invite people here to the farm to have an experience, and we've been doing that since about 1905. So it's a long tradition in growing and developing that way. The thing that really interested us in hard cider, though, is that it creates so many opportunities for creativity in adding or kind of exploring what qualities are inherent to apples when you ferment them.
Mm-hmm.
And also the kind of people it puts us in touch with and a different range of consumers. So it seemed like a logical choice for us.
Mm-hmm. And Ian, what about you? You stopped teaching and started just doing apples and cider.
Well, I started making cider actually in 1985 when I moved back from California to work mm-hmm. at Cornell. It's the local beverage. It's what you do around the Finger Lakes in October. You mm-hmm. know, you fill up your pickup truck with apples and go to the local cider mill. So at first it was just a cultural thing. We've been growing apples since the late 1980s, and if you grow apples, it's really a good idea to make cider, because there are always a lot of apples that, for whatever reason, you know, they're not dessert or fresh market. Maybe they've got a little ding, or they're a little too small, or it's a variety that isn't selling. And so if you can make cider, which is a value-added product, it just makes your whole farming operation a lot more sustainable and efficient.
That makes total sense to me. What since it's a local, it's obviously a local and cultural thing, but was it Cider Week that got other consumers interested? Did you find restaurants that would partner with you, or if it became popular in farmers markets, are there any rules about selling an alcoholic beverage in a farmers market? Like, was that a problem?
Dan, you want to go ahead with that one?
Well, not for us. Farmers markets have been a nice venue for us. I think, you know, part of the logic for us in making hard cider was that we could have a product that we could sell in farmers markets and even more broadly, and also have something that wasn't quite as seasonal as just selling fresh apples and fresh apple cider. So farmers markets were a good venue. I think that one of the things that helped was the increasing interest in locally sourced products. Cider was, New York State is such a huge apple growing state. The interest in hard cider was, I think, just an extension of the quality of products that we can grow here.
Mm-hmm. So just to take that a little further, how much acreage is devoted to apples in New York State? I know we're one of the biggest producers in the country, if not the world. But am I inaccurate in saying that? Do we produce as much as, say, China or Chile?
No. Nobody's close to China. But we're number two in the United States.
In the world at this point. New York State
is about apples grown per state.
Can you guys not hear each other?
And I'm having a hard time hearing
Ian. 38,000 acres of orchard in New York with about 750 commercial growers.
750 commercial growers in New York State, as opposed to, we'll stay with you for a second, Ian, as opposed to Washington State, which is the other big apple vector.
Yeah, Washington State produce about almost four times more than New York does, but their industry is very different. There are fewer small growers and more very large kind of corporate-owned orchards.
Mm-hmm. And so they're growing Granny Smiths and Red Delicious,
yeah,
the popular eating varieties.
And they're growing apples in a very different climate. The primary growing region for apples in Washington is the Yakima Valley, Columbia River Basin. That's a high desert area, very hot, lots of sun, no rain during the growing season. That climate really produces very different quality in the fruit, and we're in New York and New England. We've got actually a much better climate for growing cider fruit. We get more acidity, more flavor, and a lot of the traditional apple varieties from Europe and North America that are best for making hard cider actually do better in a cooler, more humid growing season.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. How much does the cider economy contribute, do you think, to New York State? Maybe I'll ask you, Ian, that question.
Honest answer is we don't know.
Really?
Because it's such a relatively new industry that there aren't good statistics on. We know there's around 60 commercial cider makers in the state now. That's almost twice more than any other state. We have numbers about sweet cider, fresh cider production, but
right,
we're actually just now trying to get the economic data on, you know, exactly how many people are working in industries related to hard cider and what's the economic impact. We don't know yet.
So, one of the things that's a little bit confusing about that, too, which it means that we need to do more careful research, is that there are a number of licensed cideries in New York State, but cider is also made by wineries and breweries, and so we're trying to get a better way of evaluating those metrics. And it is a priority for us now, too, as we're, you know, starting with a fairly new New York Cider Makers Association, and we're trying to get a clearer sense of what our industry is now and its trajectory as we're kind of moving forward. So we are trying to find a better answer to your question.
Do you think, Dan, do you think that cider will be a real sort of vehicle for economic revival in upstate New York, which I know has struggled for the last few decades, you know, between dairy farms going down and various other, you know, pressures on farmland? Do you think cider is going to revive the area?
I would like to think that it will have a positive impact that way. I think that a little bit of it depends on how the cider industry expands and develops. And cider is made in a variety of ways, but if as much as we can cultivate a market for ciders that really reflect the quality of apples that are grown and managed in a certain way, that develop flavors in cider that appeal to the customers and develop an appreciation in customers for these more special qualities in certain apple varieties, that will have a direct impact on farms that grow those varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, in contrast to, you know, the bigger mass market ciders. If the industry is predominates or grows in that direction to the expense of the smaller craft producers, then we don't know what kind of impact it will have. I think that there will be successes, and there will be individual farms that will do well. But the hope is that orchardists, maybe those who aren't even interested in making cider, we'll see the benefit to growing these apple varieties to cater to that industry, and that will be have a positive impact on their farms and a way of diversifying their farms too.
Sure, absolutely. Ian, I noticed on both of your websites that you guys have tasting notes that, you know, sound like the kinds of tasting notes you'd see for a Bordeaux or a Burgundy or something like that. So can you talk a little bit about how cider makers develop blends? Because that sort of speaks directly to your experience at Cornell, where you were, you know, teaching how to, I guess, grow apples and what different genes or different species of apples. Because I know it's an ever-evolving product in a way, isn't it? Aren't they always developing what would you call it? Is it not a species? New varietals.
Yeah, new varieties, but the cider, most of the apples that we use for cider are actually traditional. They're more likely to be heirloom or antique varieties
mm-hmm.
from the eastern U.S. or France or England or northern Spain. So we, how do you do the blends? That's really the art of cider making.
Mm-hmm.
You start with a lot of apples. I mean, we grow about 125 varieties in our orchard, and you can kind of divvy those up as sharps or apples that have a lot of acid. Other apples may be very aromatic. They're going to contribute aromas that you want in the cider. And then there are others that have a lot of tannin that'll give you sort of a texture and a mouthfeel, a kind of a complexity in the cider. And most ciders, they really are, in terms of how you make them, typically more like a Bordeaux than a California Cabernet Sauvignon or a Riesling, in that most hard ciders are blends. There are very
right.
few apples that where you can produce a really good cider from a single apple variety.
Uh-huh.
There are a few. There's Kingston Black is one that's well known for that. So basically we're blending, and typically we do the blending in the tank as we're making the cider.
Uh-huh.
We usually do 1,000-liter lots, so it's a big stainless steel tank. And within that tank, there will be at least a half a dozen apple varieties. Some of them are sharps that you want to get the acidity good. Some of them may have very high sugar content that gives you the alcohol. And then others have aromatic properties or tannins or contribute some other kind of subjective quality to the cider.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the tank ferments, there's a second blending stage where you'll often blend, one tank with another to get a... Typically, you're trying to make a cider that you've made before that people really liked, and to get something that's similar in quality and character, mm-hmm. you generally need to blend.
And, Dan, when you blend, because I'm assuming you follow the same...
Not exactly the same, but yeah, those are. I agree with everything Ian says there. Yeah.
So, how did you guys? I mean, how did you develop your signature blends? I mean, you have about what, 6 or 8 different mm-hmm. labels of hard cider, and Ian, you have 6, I think, for Black Diamond, right? And
yep.
so Dan, you when you started blending your apples, did you know sort of what you were going for, or did it kind of evolve in a natural way?
Yeah, Ian's absolutely right in saying that the best ciders with the greatest complexity are blends. And when we first began making our hard cider, we tested that hypothesis by making single variety hard ciders out of everything we can get a hold of mm-hmm. to find out which notes came through in different ciders. And then, as Ian pointed out, the art is in developing a blend of flavors that we find interesting. When we started making cider, we knew that our local customer base had little experience with hard cider, and we wanted to kind of express some of the excitement we had about cider. So we came out originally with a range from very dry and still ciders through sparkling ciders and all the way up to ice cider, which we started out with too. Ranging from very dry to kind of dessert sweet styles of cider, and then it's a continuing evolution and exploration as we're experimenting every year to find the next blend that we think might fit our portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the fun of it, too, is just to, it's also in tasting everybody else's ciders and learning from what we taste.
Very interesting. I mean, I guess one thing that I was wondering about is are apples that consistent year over year that you can sort of make up a recipe and then know that next year it's going to taste pretty much the same and you don't have to worry about deviations from, climate or soiled conditions or something like that. It's reliable.
Well, there are two things that we make our cider still in single variety batches, and we follow rough recipes for the different blends we have. But one thing that we're doing single variety batches allows us to do is to tweak the ratios a little bit so we
right.
can get a little bit of consistency. On the other hand, this is really making a wine, and I think it's consistency is a target, but it's not a hard and fast rule. And one of the things I find intriguing is the seasonal variety, variation,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's something that we can promote to let people know that this really is tied to different crops of apples, that there are climatic or seasonal variations that I think add more interest to cider.
Mm-hmm, very much
becomes
so.
A different story to tell.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. We're going to take a short break now, guys, and listen to a sponsor drop and a little music, and then we'll be right back with Ian Merwin and Dan Wilson talking about cider making. We're going to talk about cider around the world now.
Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hattica. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. We encourage you to visit brooklynslate.com for more. You can also get your own Brooklyn Slate care package by becoming a superfan member of Heritage Radio Network. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate for more.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're talking cider today in honor of the Cider Week that just passed. And I hope this will encourage people to continue to seek out ciders in restaurants around New York and beyond. Our guests are Dan Wilson, who runs the Slybro Cider House, and Ian Merwin, who has Black Diamond Cider. Guys, let's talk a little bit about the distinction between what you are making as craft brewers, I guess one would call it, and sort of the sort of typical, you know, six pack. Ian, why don't you address that, the sort of six pack ciders you referred to when we were corresponding?
So it's a pretty fundamental distinction, and the bottom line is the mass market or six pack ciders are typically made from apple juice concentrate, not from the juice of fresh apples. So juice concentrate is basically made by boiling down sweet cider in a big plant, a juice plant, and it gets rid of the water, concentrates the sugar usually up to 70-75%, and then it's put in barrels or tanker trucks, and it can be shipped from one side of the world to the other or from one part of New York State to another. So it's a global commodity made by processing apples. Craft ciders or artisanal ciders, by definition, are made from apples that are fresh pressed and then fermented.
And do you require, do you have to put yeast in them, like beer, or no? I mean, I remember when we were little, we would make hard cider by accident.
Yeah, you can. I mean, if you press apples and put them in a barrel, they'll start fermenting because there's yeast everywhere. Especially in a, you know, an apple barn or a cidery, there's yeast literally floating in the air and on every surface. So, but if you're trying to make a specific kind of hard cider, usually you will inoculate with a strain of yeast, and a lot of what we use are actually champagne yeasts that have been developed in France. Champagne yeasts or white wine yeast tend to work fairly well for ciders for a number of reasons.
Oh, interesting. Why don't you describe for a moment the global market for apples, and where does the other fruit come from? I know, Ian, you said China was a competitor. Chile. I never think of China as being a big apple producer. They don't have arable land.
25 years ago, they weren't. But when China changed its land tenure policy in the 1980s, and enabled, you know, families to have a couple of acres of land to work. Apples were one of the crops that they encouraged people to do. So traditionally they'd grown a lot of Asian pears and a few local apple varieties, but they just went into it the way they do in China. You know, you have 1.3 billion people and a couple million of them start growing apples. Within a decade, they were the number one apple producer in the world.
Amazing.
Unfortunately, initially the quality of their fruit was pretty dicey, and they grow almost entirely one variety, which is Fuji. It's a very sweet apple with very little acidity and a kind of a bland flavor, and it does not make a particularly good hard cider. But because of the quality of the fruit was not up to snuff for exporting it, or they juiced a lot of it, so they became the number one global apple juice concentrate supplier. And other major sources, Eastern Europe, right now Poland and Hungary, there's a lot of juice concentrate made there. Chile and Argentina, even southern Brazil, produce some juice concentrate. So there's one market for juice concentrate. There's a really different market for fresh apples, and the U.S. consumes most of our apples domestically. We import some, mostly during the off-season, primarily from Chile and New Zealand. And that's because, of course, their seasons are reversed from ours. So
right.
Fresh harvested apples from the southern hemisphere in late winter. So they're very different markets. And New Zealand, for example, exports, I don't think they export any juice concentrate. They're just in the fresh market apple business.
Mm-hmm. And the juice concentrate is used for sort of mass market cider and also for things like Mott's apple juice and stuff like that?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
If you read the back of your apple juice can, you know, that you buy at the supermarket, it'll say this contains apple products that can be from, and there's a long list of countries, and actually in that one can there might be juice concentrate that's come from Poland, China, Chile, and Italy, maybe.
Hmm.
So there's another really thing that happened in terms of, Ian, I might be oversimplifying this, you could fill this out, but my understanding was that when China first became a big player in the worldwide market of apples, and that really originally meant apple juice concentrate, it had a huge impact on the New York apple industry because, especially in Western New York, there was a whole segment of the apple growing, of apple growing that was focused on growing for processing and growing for juice. So there are, you know, orchards and varieties that were designed to meet that market. But when China came on the scene and they were accused originally of selling for much less than the cost of production.
Mm.
It kind of the floor went out in the market for these more locally sourced apples. So there was a quite a lot of, it was a setback for the New York industry, but also it forced a lot of growers to kind of refocus their crops or grow different varieties more for the fresh market. And I think that there's still a sense of trying to recover from that. That's actually one of that's a point that's made in the conversation around hard cider, is that by growing these special varieties, there may be a new opening for, you know, for juice quality or high quality juice apples that are, you know, that are used locally for a more specialized kind of product.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Ian, why don't you answer this first, and then Dan, you can chime in too. But what's the difference between the kind of hard cider that you guys are making and, say, like British cider or French cider, both of which are, really popular drinks in Europe? Certainly hard cider in a British pub is kind of like, you know, it's definitely the equally as popular as beer. Are those flavor notes as carefully crafted as yours, or is it more of a one-size-fits-all kind of style there?
No, it's both England and France and Spain have both craft and mass-market cider sectors.
Oh.
So I'm always a little hesitant to make a generalization, but most people, I think, would agree that British ciders typically are a little higher in alcoholic strength.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be a little more bitter. They have more of the bittersweet fruit. And most of the British ciders that get exported to the U.S. are their mass-market ciders.
Right.
Ulmer's, for example, or Thatcher's. France has a very large craft cider sector, and it's very differentiated, very evolved. It's like they make, in Normandy, they make ciders that are very different than in Brittany or Picardy or other areas of the Loire Valley. So it's...
Wow.
It's a very complex and interesting industry. French ciders, in general, are lower in alcoholic strength and tend to be fairly sweet, and the tannins tend to be a little more at the soft, astringent end of the tannin flavor spectrum rather than at the harder, more bitter end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's every country that has a tradition of making cider has a range of cider styles and covers the spectrum of both mass market and local craft ciders.
Mm-hmm. Dan, do you model some of your ciders after some of those European ciders, or do you feel like New York State and cider makers up there are really trying to create their own sort of style and brand, as it were.
Well, I think what's happening, is, as I see the local market for cider expanding, is certainly an interest in European cider varieties, because by and large, unless you go to a dozen or so northeastern heritage varieties like Sapa Spitzenberg or Northern Spy or Golden Russet, those add a lot of interesting flavor to cider. But we don't have a lot of access to some of these more flavorful varieties. So the natural tendency is to kind of go to some of these European bittersweets and bitter sharps and some French varieties, too. The thing that I think that is interesting, and I'm also paying attention to this, is that, in Europe they had this long, continuous, uninterrupted industry in cider that goes back centuries.
Yes.
And in the United States, we're still trying to reinvent cider after it kind of it was completely wiped off the map by Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And as we are introducing new ciders into the market, it's also paying attention to the market and to try to find the ciders we find that are interesting that are also correspond to, what the public is looking for in flavors. And by and large, to some extent, I think that the American market, the American flavor is not quite where it is in any of the regions in Europe.
Hmm.
I think that people have been introduced to cider through some of the mass market brands of, very sweet and fruity and highly effervescent things that are available, and that the hope is that there'll be continuing exploration and people looking for new ciders to and an appreciation for ciders that are really focused on these more unique blends of apples. As we put more trees in the ground, though, it's trying to figure out the next stage and where the consumer market is going, and so we can kind of create this thing together, both with demand from the public and from cider makers, putting out the next interesting brand of cider.
Mm-hmm. I think this is really fascinating. I mean, who knew?
Yeah.
I hadn't really given a lot of thought, as I told you before. I hadn't really thought a lot about cider, although I like it a lot. And I lived in Europe enough to develop a taste for European ciders. So, for a long time, there was no cider to be had here. And then a friend of mine started bringing ciders, but they were not what you guys are selling at all. They were mass market, and I didn't really care for them. Let me ask you this. Does the state, are you getting a legislative or financial support from the state? Is there sort of some sort of support for the development of this industry in New York State? Do you find the legislation or the legislators at all helpful in pushing this along?
Yeah. The reason we have twice as many commercial cider makers in New York State as any other state is because our state government has been incredibly proactive and progressive.
Great.
I talk to cider makers in other states and I tell them what sort of a regulatory environment we work in here. They're generally very envious. It's really started, Mario Cuomo got the New York Farm Winery Act passed in the late 1970s, and that is what really created the wine industry in New York State as a diversified farm winery, estate wineries.
Yeah.
And Andrew Cuomo, I think, is really doing something similar for craft cider makers, craft distillers, and craft brewers. They've, in the last 3 or 4 years, they've passed a whole series of new laws that liberalize things like distribution and where you can sell your cider, how you make it. Part of that law was that if you're a craft cider maker operating under a craft cider license, you're supposed to use New York apples, not imported fruit. So that, of course, created a big market for the New York apple growers. So I think New York State is just totally leading the nation in proactive, nurturing regulatory environments. And I probably the biggest thing that would help the cider industry nationally would be if other states and the federal government through the TTB, which kind of regulates wines and ciders, if they would harmonize, if they would start doing more of what New York State has done, it would be very helpful.
So in terms of like making distribution across state lines,
yeah,
like smoothing the pathway
state lines,
for that.
Alcohol content.
Yeah.
You know, what your label has to look like. I mean, you mentioned earlier, is cider the same from year to year? And it's certainly not. It's like wine, there are vintage effects, but we're not allowed to put a vintage date on a bottle of hard cider.
Oh.
You can only do that for wine. So there's a law right there. It would be really nice if we could date our ciders, because, in fact, if you make the same blend year after year, it's going to be a little different.
And does cider keep the way wine does? I mean, can you put down a bottle of cider and, you know, and open it 5 years later and have a different flavor than you might have when you first bottle it? Is there an evolution in the bottle, I guess?
It'll certainly change. I don't know how much it would improve. I think a difference, at least a commonly understood difference between cider and wine, is that it's most often drunk pretty fresh.
Uh-huh.
And I think partly because,
like,
you know, as a category, it's a little lower alcohol than wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the storage potential is maybe a little bit reduced. In that way, you know, we try to make and sell cider, you know, within 18 months of bottling,
uh-huh.
and then have new stuff available. It is, I think, a little bit fresher cider, or fresher product than a wine.
Yeah,
no,
that sounds
that's
like beer.
How you find it again? I can't hang on to it that long anyway, so it's...
I mean, yeah. Beer is better when it's fresh, too. I mean, it makes total sense to me, because it's... What is the alcohol content, by the way, for cider, typically? You know, within a range, obviously.
Usually 5 to 8%.
And beer is usually 8 to 12, is that right?
No, beer is usually lower. Beer
really?
Is typically 3 to 7 or 8%, unless you get into some kind of high-octane ale. I mean, you can
right.
push it all the way up to 10%, but...
Uh-huh. Yeah. Interesting. I didn't realize that. And can
you know, the whole thing about aging, even most wines aren't aged. You know, the life expectancy of a bottle of wine and it's purchased in the U.S. is about 3 hours. I mean, the idea that there are all these people with cellars where they're aging their Bordeaux.
Right.
And stuff like that, so.
Yeah, I think that's sort of an Edwardian concept more than a modern
exactly.
day. That's
exactly.
true. But can anyone make cider? I mean, is it hard? I was watching on Cider Week, you know, they had a whole street on Orchard Street, appropriately, with a guy making cider right on the spot. He was making the pomace, you know, grinding the apples and then putting them through the press and everything. And I watched, you have a video on yours, Dan, on the, isn't that you that has the video of the guy making cider? Or is that you, Ian?
Yeah, to answer your question, anybody can make cider.
Anyone can make cider.
Yeah.
So
anyone can.
You know, as far as the...
one at a time, please.
Home cider making project, it's probably a lot easier than making beer.
Yeah.
You know, there's just some simple guidelines to end up with a product that you really would like to drink. But that's... you know, once you get a fermentation going, either naturally with just a letting kind of endogenous or natural yeast take over, or you pitch yeast and then control temperature just to kind of slow the fermentation down, you will end up with hard cider.
Cool. Well, like I said, when I was a kid, we would buy fresh cider in one of those, you know, carboy jugs or whatever. Maybe not as big as a carboy, but you know, those glass jugs, and leave it out on the porch. And after a few weeks, if we hadn't drunk the whole thing, it would definitely have fermented by then. I must say, I loved that.
Yeah.
Even
it's
as a child.
To change.
Yeah, it was delicious.
I loved that as a kid, too. I heard you say that.
It was kind of magical, wasn't it? It was like, and then my mother would be like,
food too. The yeast has a lot of vitamin B. So.
Oh, really? Well,
oh yeah, it's good for you to drink partially fermented cider.
Well, my mother was like, "No, you can't drink that anymore." I guess she thought I would get drunk, and I, you know, of course, I was. But I was already into beer at that age, so I was like 7 or 8. Anyway.
And you've made a career of it.
I've stayed in the food business. That's right. Anyway, you guys, I guess we have to wrap it up here, but I wanted you to give you an opportunity to talk about your websites or promote something that you want to promote about Cider Week or how to get your ciders or whatever. Take it away, boys. Dan, why don't you start?
Okay. I would just encourage people who are interested in cider to keep exploring cider. The idea that there is a wide range of flavors that are available. There's a wide range of ways that you can enjoy cider when paired with food or different occasions, and that we hope that if nothing else, we can encourage that. Our website is slyboro.com, and you can order online or learn a little bit more about our place and our process. And thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure. And Ian, what about Black Diamond? Where is that found?
Yeah, we just distribute mostly within the Finger Lakes region. Some of our cider gets shipped down to New York or out of state, but mm-hmm. we're primarily a local producer and we self-distribute. I spend every Wednesday driving around with a pickup truck full of cases and cakes of cider. Our wow. websites, there's one for the farm and our apples called incredapples.com. And then there's a second one for the cidery, which is blackdiamondcider.com. And I think Dan said it very well. Cider, the wonderful thing about cider is it's kind of a no-holds-barred. It's all new. People are making hop ciders and ginger-flavored ciders.
Ooh, yummy.
It's really pretty exciting because there's a tremendous range of ciders out there and a lot of people who are new to cider. So just get on out and taste some, and in particular the drier ciders, many of which we're making in the Finger Lakes, they're very food friendly. So I'd encourage people to, instead of getting a bottle of wine for that dinner, consider getting a 750 milliliter bottle of a local hard cider. You'll find, I think, it goes really well with a meal.
Sounds great. I'm definitely going to take a trip up to those cideries this summer. Or fall. Yeah. Fall is a good time. People can come and have tastings.
There are different cider weeks around the state. The mm-hmm. Finger Lakes Cider Week is usually from about the 2nd to the 10th or 12th of October. Hudson Valley Cider Week, I think, was June last year. I'm not sure when they'll do it next year. And then, of course, New York City, you just finished your cider
That's
week.
Right.
So this stuff is all on the web. And if you keep your ears peeled, you could really... I think as the industry develops, we're going to have sort of consecutive cider weeks probably for most of the summer and into the fall.
That sounds great.
Someplace in the state. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, you guys, for joining me today. This was fun and informative. I learned a lot from both of you, and I wish you the best with the ciders. And I'll be drinking them today. I'm going to get some today.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So long, guys. And... now I want to have a little talk with my listeners. You know, this Heritage Radio Network was an experiment. It started, I think, in 2009. I was right here at the beginning, and here I still am, still doing my thing. But it has grown into something that is so much greater than I think any of us who started with it ever dreamed it would be. I mean, we are the only radio network that is exclusively devoted to food and drink. And the kinds of guests, the caliber of guests, the amount of information that we have archived and that we are going to continue to archive and put out there, and especially... as food becomes more of a kind of political issue, I think that it's really important to educate yourselves about our food systems, whether you're talking about the restaurant industry or farming or new tastes, new styles, how technology affects food. These are all things that are explored on Heritage Radio Network. We are launching our fall fundraising drive. And we need every single one of you to step up and donate to our station. It's really easy to do. There's a donate button on our website, our fancy new website. And you can start at as small a donation as you feel you can manage, or you can go up to $60 or $120 for membership. And then if you're a business that listens regularly, or you have a business that you think would be a good fit with us, there's all kinds of business packages and sponsorship opportunities that we offer as well. So I think it's really important to support this radio station because there really is nothing else like it on the airwaves. And we all really do this straight from the heart. And we look for the most interesting topics, the very best guests that we can find. And I think by and large, most of us succeed really well in doing that. So I hope you will open your pocketbooks and show your appreciation during this fall fundraising drive. And I thank you very, very much in advance for doing so. That's all for now, folks. Take care and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.